You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodore's Obvious, Misfit, Sean, DJ Jesus 72, Lee, David, Torso and Pinches, Matt, the Snarlin' Sea Dog, Hangman Strain, John, Sir Rancid Cheese, Shelby, Andrew, Axios, Vanderwood, Richard, Noah, Infamous Florida Man, Hartman, Skipper, The Sextant, Brian, Cap'n Crunch, Roger the Jolly, Vibran, Artemis Killmeister, Keelhaul Chris, Carcos, Sean, Rotary Coast, MD, Seth, Ghost 750X, Lost Again, The Navigator, Vasios, Doc Lindsay, Pitlock, Ward, Workman, Chairboat, Gunsway Sally, Cannon Monkey, Rum Runner, Madam Anita Sparrow, Hefe, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, The Snarlin' Sea Dog, and Bootstraps Bailey. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. We're going to be talking about a poem today. This poem was written in 1705. It was published in Edinburgh, and we know the publishing house which released it, but we don't know the name of the author. Still, it might be my new favorite poem of all time. The title is A Pill for Pork Eaters, or A Scots Lancet for an English Swelling. The impetus for this poem was the trial of Captain Thomas Green for high seas piracy, but A Pill for Pork Eaters goes way beyond just Thomas Green. Ever since I stumbled upon this poem, I knew that I was going to have to hang today's story on it. As such, you're going to have to listen to me muddle my way through some verses today, so I'll do my best there. A Pill for Pork Eaters begins, quote, "Heavens, are we such a servile nation grown, beneath our ancestors so vastly thrown, that every English scribbling tool elate, base miscreants and vermin of the state, hired by the mob and licensed now to prate, dares thus arraign our justice and our laws and make three villains' lives a nation's cause." This is episode 337, Vermin of the State. The author there is asking, have we, Scotland, grown so servile that every English pin dares to insult our laws by defending these three villains? The three men in question were Captain Thomas Green, the first mate of his ship, John Matter, and the gunner, James Simpson. See, this poem was written after the trial had wrapped up, after a verdict had been reached, and sentence passed but not yet carried out. These three men were found guilty of piracy, and they were sentenced to hang. But they were probably innocent. In fact, I'm pretty sure they were innocent. So is everyone else who has studied this trial. Even at the time, England knew that they were innocent and, told the Scottish that, but the Scottish weren't having it. The English knew that John Bowen, notorious pirate of the Red Seas, had in fact been responsible for the piracy for which Thomas Green had been convicted. And the Scottish looked at this evidence, comprehended it, presumably, and then tossed it out, because that's not what this trial was really about. This trial was about England and the English people, who the author of this poem calls vermin of the state. And the conflict, of which this poem was just one symptom, it was serious. There was a real danger that it might topple the government of Scotland, or maybe, worse than that, start a real war. We left Scotland last time, after the Jacobite uprising of 1691. Now, that uprising failed, but Jacobite sympathies did not die out, especially in the Scottish Highlands. The Highlands were home to something of a long-running, small-scale guerrilla war that just refused to end. You know, it wasn't Vietnam in the Highlands, but it was a problem. Mainly because it forced the Scottish government to devote military resources to the Highlands. This was a real problem because Scotland was currently embroiled in the 9 Years' War. And that brings us to the Glencoe Massacre. The Secretary of State for Scotland, Lord Stair, ordered the Argyll Infantry Regiment to march into Glencoe, demand a pledge of loyalty to King William, and if the Highlanders there failed to pledge that allegiance, the Argyll Regiment was to kill them. And that's what happened. About 30 members of Clan MacDonald were killed for, allegedly, failing to pledge allegiance to William and Mary. Now, this did not put an end to Jacobite unrest in Scotland. If anything, it added yet another cause for the Jacobites to rally behind. But in the next few years, Jacobite activity did diminish pretty significantly. So, what happened here? Well, there are lots of possible answers, but we're going to focus on two big ones. The first is political. Remember that castle we talked about last time, Castle Blair? The castle of Marquis Athol, who went down to London for his health, leaving his son in command of Castle Blair when the Jacobites captured it. And then Athol's son besieged his own castle. Now, both the Marquis Athol and his son were named John Murray, but John Murray the Younger, the man who was, you know, besieging his own castle, he was going to go on to have a brilliant career. He was eventually going to be raised the Duke of Athol and have the most powerful job in Scotland, which is a bit rich considering what I portrayed last time as an outright defection to the cause of the Jacobites. And I stand by that. But the king, either did not believe that was what happened, or chose to ignore it. What Murray and the king said happened was that the younger John Murray was not joining up with the Jacobites, he was merely keeping tabs on them. You know, shadowing their forces, maybe harrying the flanks. Those men from Murray's own ranks that went on to fight with the Jacobites, well, according to the story, they were all just a bunch of dastardly rogues who turned their coats. And maybe that's what really happened. Or maybe John Murray the Younger saw the wisdom in reconciling with the Williamite forces and King William himself after the Jacobites in Scotland had been defeated. John Murray the Younger was appointed to a council that was to investigate the Glencoe Massacre. This council found Secretary Stair culpable, and it recommended his removal from office as Secretary of State for Scotland. Now, this wasn't a problem. Everyone hated Secretary Stair. The Jacobites hated him, obviously, but so did most of the Williamites. The English, the Scottish, even the French hated Secretary Blair, so his removal was a net positive. In 1696, about a year later, John Murray the Younger, now raised to an earldom in his own right, found himself in the big chair. He was the Secretary of State for Scotland. Now, if you're a bit confused about what exactly the Secretary of State for Scotland means, you're probably an American, like me. See, our Secretary of State is the head of what in a lot of other countries would be considered the Foreign Office. But in what was quickly becoming the British Empire, you have a lot of these sovereign polities, you know, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, the West Indies, India, China. And most of these have their own Secretary of State for Wales, Ireland, Scotland, what have you. And the Secretary of State was usually the kind of de facto head of state. Officially, it was called the Officer of State, which was appointed by the king, but in terms of actual responsibilities, it was a lot like what you might find in a modern prime minister. In the case of John Murray and the Secretary of State for Scotland, that means that he held the royal seal for Scotland and sat as the Lord High Chancellor of the Parliament. So John Murray was the boss under King William. Now, he also married Catherine Hamilton, daughter of the Duke and Duchess Hamilton. The dowry involved a huge stake in the Bank of Scotland, another in the Company of Scotland, which included an interest in the Darien scheme. But back to the point, John Murray was much, much cooler to suspected Jacobites than his predecessor had been. This leniency, you know, people not marching into your hometown, demanding you swear loyalty to the king and then killing you if you fail to do so, or killing your father or brother if you fail to do so, well, that is the first reason that Jacobite activity began to die down in the 1690s. The second big reason was famine. From 1694 to 1701 or so, Scotland was living through what they called the Seven Ill Years. Now, we've talked about this before, so no need to go into real depth here, but the causes of the Seven Ill Years were threefold. First, it was cold. We're right in the middle of what they call the Little Ice Age, and the 1690s were the coldest decade in the last 750 years of recorded Scottish history. There were record crop failures, especially in 94, 95, 96, 98, and 99. Things were not going well. But other than just crop failures, the 9 Years' War on the continent was preventing the Scottish from trading with or receiving aid from their second largest trading partner, which was France. And then third, Scotland's first largest trading partner, England, was buying all of their cattle at record prices. I mean, they were spending a lot of money here, but the Scots didn't want to sell it. At least your average Scot didn't want to sell it. All of those fabulously wealthy lords who had joint estates in England and Scotland and were able to buy up all the food they needed, well, they owned most of the cattle. They preferred making money to feeding a bunch of disloyal Jacobites, so all of the cattle from Scotland, well, not all, but a lot of the cattle from Scotland, well, that was traveling down south and not filling Scottish bellies. Which makes the title of my new favorite poem make a lot more sense. The pork eaters for whom the author was offering a pill were the English, because they stole all the pork. And they were portrayed as gluttonous. One stanza reads, quote, "May England, for its luxury, be damned. Base epicures with pork and pudding crammed. Let surfeits in thy family prevail, till each disgorge a soul at every meal. And gormandizing be thy chiefest trade, till all the sons of luxury be dead." End quote. Basically saying to all the fat, luxurious gourmands in England, if you're going to steal all of our food, I hope you choke on it. Eat it until you die. The author then goes on to call London the Sodom o' the Isle, which will definitely be the title of next week's episode, so I'll stop there for now. But the Scottish were starving. The English were taking the only food they had available, and no one was doing anything about it. All of their most powerful leaders were in support of this kind of behavior. The Jacobite movement lost a lot of steam here because no one was going to support any Englishman. The Scottish Jacobites and the Scottish Williamites put aside their differences and decided, you know what? Our real enemy is England. Why fight each other when down south they're eating all of our food? But that was mostly just working class Scottish people. As we said, all of those rich upper class lords and nobles, they were all doing fine, right? Well, no. They may have had money to buy food, but the wealthiest among them were nearly ruined. When the Darien scheme failed, the Bank of Scotland lost a vast amount of money. The Company of Scotland was on the verge of declaring bankruptcy. So the uppermost crust of Scotland, we're talking about all of those Hamiltons and Murrays, people we've discussed for the last few weeks, well, they had to gamble all of their chips on trading missions to the East Indies. One of these ships, the Speedy Return, well, we know what happened to her. She was seized by John Bowen and turned into a pirate ship. But there was another ship onto which the Company of Scotland had pinned all of their hope. The Annandale. Today's episode is brought to you by Factor. I got my box from Factor recently, and I've got to tell you, I've been loving it. When I'm too busy to cook, it's great to have a meal right there waiting for me that's ready in less than 2 minutes. There was one meal that I just fell in love with. It was chicken in a garlic cream sauce, which was great. But then they had this garden herb butter cauliflower, and it's not the word they used, but it was like a risotto. I mean, it was rich and decadent. It was so good, in fact, that I've been trying to make it at home, but I've yet to find the secret. My favorite bit, though, is that they sent me these wellness shots. They're a juice that's mixed with certain kinds of herbs and spices. My favorite is lemon, apple, ginger, honey, turmeric, and black pepper. I really can't recommend enough all of Factor's chef-crafted, ready-to-eat meals. So head on over to factormeals.com/pirate50 and use code PIRATE50 to get 50% off. That's code PIRATE50 at factormeals.com/pirate50 to get 50% off.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Now, I don't want to give the impression here that these Company of Scotland trading vessels were operating entirely above board. They weren't. The legal waters tend to get a bit murky when it comes to trading in India. Portugal and the Netherlands had trading rights in some East India Company ports, not others, but Scotland, at least the Scottish Company, was not permitted to trade in any East India Company port. But the Scottish Company said, fine, we can deal with that. There are, of course, plenty of other places we can buy our spices, like, I don't know, the Malabar coast. There's a very good chance that these Scottish ships trading in the East Indies were trading at the Malabar coast, trading in those very same ports frequented by the pirates, you know, John Bowen and his ilk, when they were at Malabar. It's possible, even likely, that these Scottish Company ships were buying some of those spices that the pirates had stolen from the East India Company. But is what they were doing illegal? You know, they were just buying spices from independent spice merchants in unaffiliated ports that were not associated with the East India Company. However, the East India Company considered India theirs, if it wasn't one of the few Portuguese or Dutch holdouts, that is. According to the Company of Scotland, though, these were independent proprietors with whom we are free to do business. Then, in late 1703, one of these ships, the Annandale, sailed into the Thames. She had just returned from India and was looking for supplies and repairs, and maybe to sell some of her spices, if the East India Company would allow. But on orders from the EIC, the Annandale was seized by the Admiralty. The crew was accused of smuggling and piracy and classed officially as a privateer ship. But she wasn't a privateer ship. The problem here is that Queen Anne did not recognize the Scottish Company as legitimate. So, it's a privateer. An illegal privateer. Now, I can't find many details about the Annandale, but it's almost certain that her cargo was taken by the East India Company, the captain likely imprisoned, and the ship probably appropriated by England. As one of the few ships on which Scotland pinned her hopes, that's not great. This was in November 1703. On 19 July 1704, the English ship Worcester arrived in Scotland. First, they stopped off at Fraserburgh, then onto Edinburgh. The Worcester was just returning from a voyage to the East Indies, where they had traded in spices. Now, the Worcester was not an East India Company ship, but she did have a license from the East India Company to trade in India. And I'm not exactly sure why the Worcester sailed up to Scotland. At least there are differing accounts here. First, we have the account given in the trial of John Green and his crewmates, but as we'll see, that's not a very reliable account. Then, on the other hand, we have the account given by the owners of the Worcester, who sued the Scottish Company in the aftermath of everything that's about to happen. So you've got to kind of split the difference here, because everybody's got an agenda. To me, it looks a lot like this unofficial East India Company ship was trying to sell their Indian spices to the Scottish after the East India Company had stolen a ship full of Indian spices. This looks like they were trying to circumvent the Company of Scotland, which was probably the point. Now, the Company of Scotland had a clause written into their charter that gave the company carte blanche powers of reprisal. See, should their property be attacked, their ships, their captains, were empowered to take it back or take back an equivalent amount. Originally, though, this was intended for use on the Spanish Main. When they were colonizing Darien, they were worried that the Spanish would come along and try to stop them. But when the English captured one of their ships in London, the company considered that cause for reprisal. It took about a month for the decision to finally be made, but the Scottish decided to capture the Worcester. And they did so in a most piratical manner. There was a secretary in the Company of Scotland, Mr. Roderick Mackenzie, who had had some unfortunate dealings with the East India Company in his past. He didn't like them. And he proposed a plan, quote, to get together a sufficient number of such genteel, pretty fellows as would, of their own accord, be willing to accompany me on this adventure. End quote. He collected 11 men who agreed to help him in his endeavor, which was fully backed by the Company of Scotland. On the 14th of August, 1704, Mackenzie and 10 of his fellows sauntered down on the docks. Their, quote, dress and behavior would not render them suspected of any uncommon design, end quote. They were wearing, you know, fancy clothes. They had ostentatious swords belted on their hips. They carried jugs of wine punch, and several of them had pistols secreted about their person. This garish-looking crew visited every ship in the harbor. They shared punch, they told jokes, they sang bawdy songs, and just generally were welcoming hosts to the men in the harbor. Now, all of the sailors on those other ships were having a great time, enjoying the hospitality. So when these 11 men arrived at the Worcester, they were just invited on board. The 11 men poured out mugs of punch for the crew, and then they were invited into the captain's cabin. And in the captain's cabin, they were having a great time. Singing, laughing, telling dirty jokes. Mackenzie called it, quote, a most complete scene of comedy, end quote. Captain Thomas Green of the Worcester and his fellows really let their guard down. And it was at that moment that every officer in the cabin had a pistol at his ear. The gunner, Mr. Simpson, tried to rush for a blunderbuss that was hanging above the door, but one of Mackenzie's men fired his pistol, missing, but convincing the officers that it was best to surrender. Before the day was out, all of these officers were hauled off to jail, and the ship was under the protection of the Scottish Company. I've read the transcriptions of a fair few trials from this era, but I really can't count this one among them, because this trial was not a trial. It was a condemnation. The court heard the pleas of the accused, but that's about it. You know, the men accused of piracy were given lawyers, but the lawyers presented no defense of their clients. John Green and his men weren't allowed to offer testimony or evidence in their defense. It's not even really clear that they were allowed to speak. The transcript of this trial isn't a transcript. Usually you'll have someone writing down what everyone says, and sometimes, if you're lucky, you get some fun verbal sparring between the pirates and the prosecutors, but there's none of that here. The transcript is basically just an essay written by the prosecution and the judges in what was essentially a defense of the quote-unquote trial of Thomas Green and his men. They'd already decided the verdict. But they did have witnesses in favor of the prosecution. There were two men enslaved aboard the Worcester, Antonio Ferdinando and Antonio Francisco. Both of these men testified that their ship, the Worcester, under Captain Green, raised a red flag, attacked another ship, filled with what they said were either English or Scots, and that Captain Green, First Mate John Matter, and the gunner, James Simpson, all killed men during the capture of that ship. And all of that might be true. It's possible that the Worcester, under Captain Thomas Green, did engage in a little light piracy while in the Indian Ocean. But even if all that did happen, it was not the Speedy Return. The men who may or may not have been killed in that act of piracy did not include Captain Drummond, nor did it include Andrew Wilkie, the surgeon, aboard Speedy Return. But those two Antonios claimed that is what happened. I'm sure it's a pure coincidence that the man who was questioning the two Antonios was the brother of Andrew Wilkie, who stood to inherit quite a bit from their parents, with his elder brother out of the way. And of course we know today what actually happened to the Speedy Return. This kind of thing wasn't uncommon. You know, people got accused of piracy all the time. Whether or not they did it, they were almost always convicted and often killed. What makes this case interesting, though, is that the people at the time knew that this was not what happened. Some of the men from Speedy Return made it back to England while this trial was going on. The Admiralty knew who they were and questioned them and found out what actually happened to Speedy Return. So the Admiralty of England sent missives up to the court there in Scotland telling them that, you know, hey, we know that what they're saying isn't true. It also came out during the trial that those two enslaved men were actually chained up under the forecastle while the piracy was going on. It would have been impossible for them to see who was killed and who did the killing. With all of these new revelations, the court, for a minute, seems to have been leaning in the direction of acquittal. But that wasn't going to fly. Not for the people who had lost so much in their investment in the Darien scheme, nor for the average people of Scotland. The court and the Parliament had a lot of pressure from above, all of those wealthy investors, and a lot of pressure from below, the regular people of Scotland. That pressure from below came in the form of a huge, angry mob. The people in this mob were unwilling to listen to any kind of defense of these English dogs. I mean, they were so obviously guilty. And then you've got works like A Pill for Pork Eaters floating around, making the rounds and fanning the flames. And some of the passages in there were downright combustible. One of them reads, quote, "But England, insolent and proud like hell, whose saucy boldness naught but blows can quell, dare now our laws and sentences canvass, and censures on our justice pleadings pass." Saying there that the English listen to nothing but violence, and they dare to cast judgment on our court system? The passage goes on, "But if by providence a tar is driven upon our coasts, and here, a villain proven, let him be English and the devil to boot, he dies a white and spotless saint, no doubt." The author's saying there that if a tar, you know, a sailor, if they're proven to be a villain in Scotland, as they believed that the men of the Worcester were, even if it were the devil himself, if this person proved to be English, the English would claim he was a spotless saint. It continues, "Our magistrates and churchmen are abused, and we as thieves and murderers accused, for Drummond is at Madagascar till, so say your post knights, credit them who will." And this has to do with some of the testimony from those men who were aboard the Speedy Return. They claimed that Captain Drummond turned pirate and stayed at Madagascar, which was probably true. But the Scots refused to believe it because it was coming from the mouths of vile, smelly English scoundrels. It goes on, "Then England, for its treachery, should mourn, be forced to fawn and truckle in its turn. Scots peddlers you no longer durst upbraid, and Darien should with interest be repaid." End quote. He's saying that for English treachery, in the final days of the colony at Darien, the English nation should pay. This trial was not about justice for the Speedy Return, or about the guilt of men like Thomas Green. It was about justice for Darien and the Annandale, and it was about the guilt of all Englishmen. We're going to leave it there today, with great mobs menacing the Parliament, the manor houses of Scotland's greatest noble families, and the very government of Scotland, with the lives of three English sailors hanging in the balance, and the very possibility of war between two ancient kingdoms, a very real possibility. Next time we're going to finish the story of Thomas Green, and we're going to look at some of the very first steps taken toward union. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who helps to support the show, all of our patrons on Patreon, everybody who has recommended this show, and everybody who has left us ratings or reviews. Without all of you, I couldn't do this. Thank you. The Pirate History Podcast is a member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you'd like to check out some of their other fine shows, like American Revolution Podcast, which shares some theming with what we've been talking about today, you can do so at airwavemedia.com. Our theme music was The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out, you can do so on Spotify, Bandcamp, YouTube, or wherever fine music is found. After you're done there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.